So we can just show the end where they, when everyone has come, we can.
Yeah, you can then disperse the citizens and tell them to go home. So now we're just unregistering random people from the encampment, and then they continue their regular lives again.
So that's how you do events. You would tell them to like abort your life cycle, and now you do as I say.
And these groups are supposed to be pickable by the police, so that, or the players, so that they can interact with the demonstration how they want. At which angle do they want to approach the people, with what kind of units? If you send like military units to villagers, they might just get very enraged. While sending civilian or people in regular clothes might not make more frustration or, yeah.
So we also did some fixes with rendering. Like in general, there was a lot of issues and we can't really show them all here. But we had to do a lot of other issues to like properly show what we have been doing. And rendering was one of the parts. As when you make an isometric game, you usually want different units to act differently. When they are like behind buildings, you don't want to draw them and so on. And we saw two different approaches for doing this. The first would be to cut all the buildings in two and have the bottom on the layer which will always be in behind, making sure that the citizen would walk in front, and then have the top of the building on another layer, and then hide the player behind, and the human. However, that would make a lot of work for the asset creators, as well as we wanted to do this programmatically, so we decided to use Unity's setdept to, by checking the Y position of the different objects, we gave them different setdepths, which then would alter the drawing order, which makes sure that when this citizen is behind the key line, he will be drawn behind the building.
We also have all the roads to the bottom layer, so that they're always on the top of the node behind the citizens.
Yeah, and it also led to some limitations, because in true, this is not a line, it's actually a point. So it's when the building is not quadratic, it's really hard to make it possible for the citizen to walk properly behind the different edges of the building. So in this case it's fine because he will always be behind at the same time. But if you have like a long building, he will be behind much later in one of the directions, and that would cause issues. However, that could be solved by cutting it in two. But we did like a decision to just keep with square buildings.
So there's still a lot of further development left in the game, is scheduled to be done later this summer, and we still like the police interaction, there's concept of zones, like how can you affect larger parts of the city at once rather than it only being no place, and also the scenario builder for setting up the different populations you want to take part in the scenario, or adding the events. So these are parts that still need to be finished before we can consider it a proper educational tool.
So in conclusion, I would say it has been a very successful project. We have stumbled upon issues, but they have always been able to be solved. And while there are some parts which we would like to fix and look into, that will be future work. We learned a lot, like for instance, how to work in a team. We worked with people we had never worked with before, and in different countries, and figured out how important communication is.
And working with people with more experience than you is also a great experience, as they have great input and like.
Yeah. It was also interesting to work with people who are not game designers, who actually create the design of the game. So then you have to figure out, how can we make this fun? How can we create these ideas which they haven't actually managed to put them into the game? And it made some interesting challenges. And we got really good feedback from the different locations. They knew what they wanted, and they said their opinions.
So I'm not just going to be focused on Florence and Vienna, as well as the continuous communication with Hugo, which the month is currently staying in Lisbon, so this on-site is just in the transition.
So it's three iterations. When we are finished now, that's the first iteration, which means Simon and the rest of the team will continue to work on the project. And during the summer, they will hopefully be able to create a finished project which can be given to different police officers and start the training. And then we have the third iteration, which will be for the general public to make it more of a game experience. removing content which is too complex and making it more entertaining in general.
And I would like to congratulate Frederick for getting a job through this project due to the connections we've gotten. And I've also gotten some connections that will be relevant for my master's later, so.
Yeah. Questions? So everything that has to do with the citizens and these models and all those kind of things.
Pathfinding, like the caution part where you're skeptical of scary areas and that's actually for the citizens. Yeah, well, the main focus of the game as a part of CityCop is to be an educational project. So it's hopefully that we can release it to the general public, however, we're not certain that we've made it such an entertaining game as more as an educational game. So,
what's your opinion on that?
Well, we could have limitations, and it should be noted that the city builder and the scenario editor are not available for the public when the game is finished. They will only receive like the existing levels, the playthrough, and those will be designed with the average player in mind, rather than a trained police officer who knows how to relate to different businesses.
We can also make the game more entertaining as they actually progress, making sure they actually want to go further into the game, like adding different kinds of police units you can upgrade, and you can start to like build different tactics. I think some of the gamers would like to do that rather than just destroying the city. It might be fun like the first times, but then you are still stuck on level one, so it might not get so entertaining over time.
Yeah,
that's true. And that might be very interesting when you have these choices from the police, so that they could like either go to school or like beat them up, or you could log that kind of thing and see what would general people like the police to do. That would be interesting to have the statistics on.
We're also supposed to log the events so that we have a report functionality for the game, so that when the police play the different levels, they can replay it and discuss what actions the player took and how that affected the environment and what could they have done better instead. So, yeah, for educational purposes, and then...
Yes. I think we can both tell. He can start with his and I can say mine.
I would make more constructs rather than using the existing toolkit, because there are lots of bugs based on the toolkit that we used. Example was the grid manager, where we didn't equip to determine what node a citizen was in, and we only realized this was an issue when they were between nodes or close to the edges, because then it would register to the wrong node due to how they...
You could draw it if you want.
Yeah, okay. So
it's an interesting issue.
What they did was, we have these squares, they're not to drive, and they did that certain radius of the center of the mold. And that's an issue because if you take things outside, it's also slow because you check every node in the grid and you just abort once you find one who satisfies the circuit requirement. And we changed it to doing like translations of the grid. So we move the grid and then we scale the grid and then we rotate and scale it again so we can directly map into the indices, which is a little faster and which is a change we've submitted for them to keep in the existing toolkit, so we give them feedback as well.
Yeah, so, yeah, and for me, I used a lot of time in the beginning to study the kit and go into the into the classes and the structures, and I realized that a lot of the things didn't end up being used at all. So I think I wasted a lot of time researching the actual kit. It might have been inevitable, but I think it was because of the ideas was kind of all over the place in the beginning. It was hard to figure out should the groups be done using their like battle system, or how should we like use the different modules which they had created. And also, I think all of our biggest bugs has been by the kit itself. So it made some challenges there. So as probably the same as him, like make more from scratch.
Or not.
It seemed that having this plugged in actually helped it.
Yes.
Crackle.
Yeah. You heard like the static instead, just tiny, tiny.
Yeah,
static.
I think you get a hit.
Yeah.
You hear a tiny amount of static because I think
it
has a signal.
It prioritizes that one.
Yeah, over the
yeah.
background noise. So.
Just keep it on.
Yes. Potentially,
yeah.
It might be safer. You can wear it if you like.
Oh, I'd rather not. I have. I don't think I would handle hearing myself talk while I talk.
Right.
So
it's not too bad.
So yeah, as Simon said, this is the Nox SS, which is a multi-threaded entity component system developed by Trond Lona and me, Permoden Starla. This was requested by our employer, Sutring Digital, which is a local company, and the project was supervised by Mariusz Nowoslawski. So this is just a quick overview of what we're going to talk about. First, we're going to introduce our problem that we were supposed to solve with a quick introduction to the existing Nox engine. Then we're going to give a brief description of the problem and restrictions that we actually faced. And then also a quick introduction to what entity component systems are, for those of you who don't know. And then we're going to move over to our solution, which is basically going to focus on how we made a new system that is performing relatively better than the other one, which our system is the green one here, and the purple one being the already existing one. So quite a performance improvement. So we're mainly going to talk about the sort of factors that contributed most to that, which is the high-level architecture, our simple meta-information structure, and our latest execution models. Then we're going to discuss some benchmarks before moving over to our conclusion, and then questions are obviously asked or answered at the end. So with that, I think.
Yeah, so first we're going to talk about Nox engine, which is the engine we extend from. It was originally developed by Sutring Digital, which it is a simple 2D engine. It started out as Project Nox, which some of the key developers in Sutring Digital, which they developed it here at the school in one of the courses. It was further developed in their bachelor thesis, and then after graduation, they also continued working on it, and it became the engine which it is today. Then it is also open source, so anyone is free to check it out, try it out, and try to develop it themselves as well. And then we have the description of what we actually practice all here. So what we want to do is to create an alternative to their game object model. So their game object model called Nox Accuracy System, we want to create an alternative, which is our Nox ECS. The main goals we want to achieve with this alternative is to have higher performance, and we want to achieve this by introducing multi-threading, which they don't have. We also want to have a more cache awareness structure, so more coherent, the more contiguous memory is important for us, and basically the structure overall we have to think about. We also want to avoid the virtual functions, so we don't have a necessary overhead in the form of a virtual pointer, and a lot of other things that negative things that brings. So we can also desire template minimalism. This is to avoid higher compilation times, as it already was quite high, and it hampered development, so further increasing it would be quite bad. We also have a few philosophies we followed when developing this module. First was a focus on aggregation, which is pretty much what empty component systems are all about. Also, we follow the C++ mantra of don't pay for what you don't use, which you can see in our layered execution model later. We also want to avoid unnecessary abstraction, which was somewhat of a problem in their original Nox accuracy system.
So here's a quick introduction to what the entity component systems are. So entity component system is a game object architectural pattern which favors aggregation over inheritance, and it's like many other things, best described by a contrived example. And in this case, we have a simple player object, which can be controlled by some sort of input, so a gamepad. And we also have an enemy object, which is controlled by an AI. So obviously, the one approach here is to inherit from an input controllable base class for the player, or a AI controllable base class for the enemy. And seeing as both of them are game objects and need like positions in the world, etc., they obviously inherit from the game object base class. And this design, as I said, is sort of contrived, but it also leads to some flexibility issues. Say that we want to add a spell where you can control enemies. That's not really easy to add here, because we would have to have a way to introduce the gamepad or input controllable ability to the enemy. A more elegant solution would be to go for an aggregate solution, where we simply have the game object there, and it has a pointer or some sort of reference to a controller interface, which is implemented either by an AI controller or by an input controller. And then if you need to throw the spell, as we discussed earlier, you would simply change the sort of underlying implementation, which can also be done on the fly. So it's relatively simple to implement and relatively flexible. So that's just sort of the quick overview of our problems. Now we're going to jump into our solution, starting with our high-level architecture. So this is a relatively simple model of UML model of the architecture that we have gone for. We see here our entity at the top, which is sort of the main point to focus on. It's sort of stapled here because we don't actually have entities directly within the ECS. We only have components that share entity IDs. So an entity is basically made up of the components that share the same ID. So we can have, if we move back to the previous example of having input controllers, you could have the player being entity one, or the player having the ID one, and it's identified through the input controller, which also has the ID one. These components are stored in a component collection, which helps us solve the problems of cache awareness while also avoiding template stuff. So it's basically a container that works more on raw memory rather than using type information, and also allows us to work with more contiguous memory. Components can also send and receive events, however we're not really going to go into that for this presentation. And also each component collection is stored within the entity manager, which is sort of the interface out for the user. So now we're going to move over to the more important types here in addition to the architecture, which is the meta information and operation types, which as you can see here sort of describes, as I said, it describes the type while the operation types operates on components. And these are ways of solving type information related issues and implementing our own virtual functionality. So as I said, the meta information contains relevant type information, like the size of each object. It also contains what we call operation types, which are basically function pointers, which is our replacement for virtual functions. So we wanted to try to find another way of dealing with dynamic polymorphism rather than the function pointers, as they add a small overhead, but still an overhead we can to a certain degree avoid. So we created the operation types, which is basically that on a per component type basis, we store the meta information where we set up function pointers to the implementation functions of the subclasses, rather than storing the vtable pointer as a member of the class, which points to an array, which points to the different function implementations. Having this allows us to do some cool stuff. For instance, we remove the per instance space overhead of virtual pointers. Additionally, they're relatively versatile, so we don't actually have to point to member functions. We can also set them up to point to freestanding functions. And also they are made to work on ranges, which also helps with the cache awareness stuff. Additionally, we can also detect whether or not functions have been overridden in subclasses by doing a relatively simple SVNR template trick. And while templates weren't really encouraged for this project, this is templates that aren't sort of, they don't burden the actual engine, they sort of burden the user. So you only pay for the extra compilation times in how much you introduce new operation times, but you don't have to recompile the entire engine by when you introduce new type. So that's the sort of quick and dirty of the meta information.
Yeah, and then we have the layered execution model, which is the way we decided to solve having multi-threading our components. So introducing multi-threading into our module is an improvement to a few of problems that you get with multi-threading. Now we need to be properly synchronized each thread so they don't introduce race conditions by having shared variables as such. So, and since we don't have no idea like specifically how each component works because they can introduce new ones, it, like anything can happen, right? So what we choose to do is to have each have a layered approach where each layer holds a set of components, and these components, a component set in each layer, can be run concurrently. So our algorithm does this sorting into layers by basing it on data gained from the user, so the programmer. And these come in two forms, in the form of data access, which is how it describes how a component acts with other components, and a read list, which describes what components the components read from. So first, the data access. Independent means that a component can be run concurrently with any other thread. Read only means that it has some need to other component, from other components. Read write would mean that it has some read and some write, but it's not implemented, so it's pretty much handled as a known, which is a default, which means we have no idea what this component does, so we just are pessimistic and say, okay, it can't be run concurrently with anything, so to make it safe. So if you see on the top right, that's like a representation or an illustration of what the set of components could be like in a game. So each circle represents a component, and each arrow represents like a read, and the 8 is an exception, it's an unknown, so it's drawn differently. And if you look down below, that's a representation of how we want to end up, so that's the layered execution model. So you can see each separate layer, which is separated by the horizontal line. And you can also see the 8, which is at its own layer because it can't currently exist on one. Also, you might see that it's split nicely into 3 and 3, but it's try 2. This is because we also want to take into account how many threads you have available when actually running these components. So in this example, we just pick numbers of 3. So we want to keep the amount of components in each layer divisible by the amount of threads you have. This is because if you, for example, on the second layer, add another one with a 4. So let's assume that you have somewhat similar workload on these components. The first 3 would work on the first 3 components, be done at a somewhat similar time. Then we have one more component to work on, but 3 threads. So 2 threads will have to wait while the one of the others actually does the work. So it's probably better to just move those components further down to the layers below to actually fill those out better. So now the actual algorithm. So going step by step, so we see on the left, we start here, we already have the 8, the unknown one, since we already know it can't be placed with anyone else, we just place it right away. Then we quantify how many reads each component has with other components, and then we sort them. So we see the top, the 2, which has the most, and one at the bottom, which has 0. Then we first pick out the first component we want to create in our layer. This will be the one with the most read counts, which is 2 in this case, and we invalidate the component that has read access with it. So in this case, 4 and 7. So they are now colored in red. So now the next step will be to add more components, but now we want to add the ones that add the fewest new invalidations. So that we don't want new red components, basically, which means we can add more and more components as much as possible. So we choose 1 because it has no new ones. And then on left that we add 3, which has 1 new component, and it invalidates the number 5. Now we could try to add 6 and 9 to the layer, but we want it to be divisible by 3, and the next number of that is 6, and we'll have 2, so it's not possible, so we just say, okay, we're done with this layer, and then we move to the next layer, and we now use the components we haven't left, so the invalidation won't become possible to use it. And that's pretty much the algorithm in Linux, kind of. And then we start with our benchmarks. We first start with task spawning. This test is pretty much to compare how fast each module is able to spawn and delete components, and well, actors and their components. We do this spawning and deleting operation 10 times, as you might be able to see in the graphs. The graphs represent allocations and deallocations of memory over time. The test is a little bit faulty in the fact that our Nox CSS doesn't support the same amount of features that the original Nox Actor system supports. So for example, so JSON support, which means we have fewer member variables, so the amount of memory will, like, there's not on the same terms, so it's a bit in our favor. However, if you see the numbers below, Nox Actor system peaks at 90 megabytes and our peaks at 45 megabytes. So we're at about half and we don't really think we will catch up to them even though we add the full support of all the features. We think. It's just an assumption. Also, if you look there, Nox Actor is the one that above and ours is the one below. If you can see that we have a much better memory retainment, so we don't, since their valleys in comparison to peaks are much lower, or the difference is much bigger than on ours, on the peaks below, which means we have some stuff in memory to allocate and deallocate memory all the time, or not really the same amount.
Yeah, so the next benchmark we looked at was the one called numerous unique components, which was a more general test case. Basically, the way we did this test was to have a certain amount of entities in the world with a number of unique components. In this case, each entity in the world had 20 components, which did mock work, while we scaled from 100 to 1,000 entities. And then we looked at basically how long would it take to do 10 iterations of sort of the game loop, and each component was basically just doing this awaiting. And as you can see here, this is the graph we showed earlier, that we sort of perform better than the Nox Actor system. We also scale better. And it should be noted here that for this test case, we actually had so half of the components were required to read from other components so that we wouldn't get an embarrassing parallel problem. While a quarter of them were unknown, and the last quarter were independent, so they could run concurrently with almost anyone. Additionally, we did some benchmarks for an internal optimizations to check what gains we actually got from the different implementations that we talked about. So the execution layers was the one that we got the most gains from. We got some minor improvements using our own virtuals, and we also got some minor improvements using local memory. Additionally, we have this concept of type identifiers, which we use to identify component types, which can either be created through hashed strings or directly through numerical values, and we wanted to check the difference between using the hashed strings or the numerical values. And a graph is shown here describing the different ones. It's a relative scale, so we're sort of at the one here, and once you're moving sort of down to the 0.50, then you're moving half as fast as our regular version. So as you can see, we gained the most by adding the execution layers. However, the impact of that starts diminishing over time, and that's mainly because we're starting to use more and more time of the program in event handling and stuff, which currently isn't properly multi-threaded, so the impact isn't that much. But you can see that we are consistently beating the regular in-place virtuals, and also the virtuals which uses, or also the times we're using components which are just randomly allocated on the heap using unique pointers. Additionally, as you can see, the type identifiers sort of hampers performance quite a lot when we're using strings rather than numerical values. That test is sort of flawed because there might be done some allocation behind the scenes there, but it shouldn't be because the sort of short string optimization that different compilers use should catch up to that. But it's still some extra overhead of doing like caching and stuff. So that's the general benchmarks. So our conclusion is sort of that performance should perhaps be thought of at a more architectural level, as seen in the last graph, that the individual optimization did not improve that much, with the exception being the execution layers. However, they were like directly allowed by our architecture. So that's sort of something that should be focused on when you're planning a new system.
Yeah, and there's also a lot of future work we want to do. For example, we want more representative test cases in the form of proper counter test cases. So we talked about wanting to avoid templates earlier. We would also want like on out with templates to create a full template solution rather than doing the meta information, all of that stuff, so to see what kind of impact would it actually have to compilation time. Or would it be faster or slower, or would the interface be worse or better? We also want to test on mobile platforms. This is because we did try to do some optimizations aimed at mobile platforms, mainly taking advantage of their weak memory model in the multi-threading parts. We also wanted to use local compiler for the test. We only use Clang, but it would be nice to also include, we only use a GCC, I mean. We also like to use Clang and the Visual Studio Compiler.
So in general, what we've achieved is a significant performance improvement, while not really sacrificing that much functionality, but simply rethinking the approach in a more sort of multi-threaded term, or in a more multi-threaded way. So with that, is there any questions? Mainly because of issues setting up the mobile testing is, so the engine also supports desktop, which is what we're most used to targeting, so it's sort of, it supports both, it just happens that they're also built for mobile. And it was basically related to issues setting up with the testing, and that we wouldn't necessarily be able to create, create a representative test case anyway, but you know, it would be more difficult to do that on mobile. But it's on the list of stuff that should be done, because it is sort of screwing with the with the results, or in one way at least. Additionally, there are some optimizations that are done that seem sort of contrary to mobile, which is why we have added some support for turning certain feature off, which we might also which we should also extend to other parts of the system. So, for instance, the way we're hogging memory might not necessarily be a desirable feature on mobile. You might want them to release that more. However, that's something that we can add to sort of macro solutions, which is what we've done with the execution errors. Well, the most we're trying to take advantage of caching is how it's kept, sort of, so that we're trying to get the most important information first, which is what we're usually interested in. So the different caching mechanisms, that is sort of a hardware optimization level that we want to go to, but we haven't sort of had the time to really dive deep there, because we are aware that there are different issues there, so that's, yeah, something that needs to be improved upon. Which is one of the reasons that we wanted to avoid, sort of, for instance, the virtual pointer overhead. The space overhead isn't that important, but you know, when we're using the first 8-byte just to point to something that we technically know at compile time. Obviously, a cooler solution then would probably be to use sort of like depth typing with templates, but then we're introducing templates again, so. We haven't actually had the time to test that properly. So what we did when we were doing our test was that we tried to minimize those sort of things. So we were trying to run our tests as much in isolation as possible, turning off all other functionality and turning off. So for instance, we turned off everything from like we turned off all our background programs, obviously, and then we also did like CPU frequency scaling to fix those sort of issues to try and get consistent results. But obviously, that is something that should affect the data.
Yeah, we try to do that all the time, except on the last layer, which we possibly end up having fewer components than possibly fit in a layer. For example, in the model we had, we only had two left on the end, so we couldn't really fill it out, so one would have to wait. Either way, there's
and
no way to solve it.
Obviously, we're using a thread pool, so we're actually reusing all the threads, so they don't actually stop before until the program is actually terminated, so we don't do joining or anything.
So I need the not really add significant extra.
That's one of the things that we have the most problem with trying to defend, is the lock-free stuff. Just be completely honest about that. So for mobile, it might have some benefits, but we were unable to test on mobile. We were wondering if we could see any performance in general at the x86, just like for interest. But we weren't really finding anything, or we weren't finding improvements. We were finding some places where we were pessimizing the system, mainly because, for instance, our allocation algorithm doing the lock free one sort of turned a bit more complex, so there's probably just easier to take a lock and just go. Additionally, the reason that we went lock free there is sort of like, it's not based on anything. It was an oversight for me at least, because I was motivated by learning about memory ordering and stuff like that. So obviously, the better solution, which I sort of noticed when I was writing the report, was that, hey, why don't we just give each spread their own allocator and their own queue, and then we don't have to do any synchronization at all before we start reading from it. So that means that we are both removing the mutex solution while also removing the lock-free one, which would be, But mainly the problem with doing the relaxed memory orderings was that we had to It didn't really increase complexity that much in terms of difficulty. However, it required you to know a bit more about the system. So we, because we always try to sort of spec ourselves towards the known known situation, allowing us to sort of go around certain lottery programs, such as the ABA problem, which we completely circumvented by just saying, hey, you're not allowed to like delete stuff like dynamically. You can only release it a certain times.
Pretty much run the entire like all the tests we displayed, we could run just a quick run and it's all done. Well, you would also need to like sort out the data we gained, but all the tests would like automatically run. We don't run the script to get the files and we just start them.
So in general, the testing framework is actually quite robust. It's just that we ran into a lot of issues with the other stuff surrounding the testing framework.
Yeah.
So for instance, CMake, which decided not to set the variable that we told it to set because you have to like force it to update variables and stuff, which we sort of noticed a bit later in development, which is why some of the results in the thesis aren't run as many times and stuff. And so there's mainly been like a lot of issues that has come up, which you mainly notice once the result come in and say like, hey, this definitely makes sense, and then we have to like run the test again overnight. And yeah, so the running more tests and more continuously isn't an issue. It's something that we want to improve upon so that we can automate that for other people to try and verify the results. Because the plan is to merge this into the Nox engine once we're done, and then people will probably try to see if they can get the same performance improvements that we have. And usually they just forward, so we've looked at some of the different implementations. So for instance, the regular music mutex on POSIX just forwards to the pthreads one anyway. So mainly we wanted to see if we could get any benefits, not by avoiding to take the log, but rather by guaranteeing system-wide progress, which is the other part of it. So we don't actually have that data for doing comparisons here. I'm not sure if we mentioned it in the thesis.
I don't know, but it would add overhead by just having the multivariate mechanism, so it probably would run slower than a single thread.
No, because we wouldn't do the multivariate mechanisms if you're running single thread.
Oh.
Which we've obviously
right.
Put in a switch for, because then it's, you know, sort of wasted.
Yeah.
However, that sort of depends on the use case. So for instance, the event system we have now is relatively shit. And that takes up a lot of time, which is also why as you saw, the execution layers were scaling sort of on the individual optimizations. We still believe that there are performance improvements to be gained by just thinking about it that way, at least compared to the original system, which was sort of jumping all around in memory. But we need to do more testing on that before we could say definitely that the system would be faster also running in the single thread environment. But my gut feeling says yes, because in general it does less work.
Okay, thank you.
didn't get any crackle in that, so hopefully it's doing its job of defending against crackle.
We set out with two main goals for our bachelors. Sebastian and I wanted to design and implement the game using a professional game engine, while Petter wanted to learn more about Vulkan and implement the dynamic destruction of models. As Petter's work could potentially increase the performance of our game and add some cool features to it, we decided to collaborate and make this a unified team. Project Awasin is a dungeon crawler game, primarily focused on diverse character customization through talents and stats. Goals for our finished product will include a refined inventory system, complex statistics system, diverse talent choices, and randomly generated dungeons, as well as the Vulkan integration previously mentioned. So creating a game is a very big task, and as we kind of knew we wouldn't be able to create a whole game in the allotted time for this thesis, we decided to focus on the systems driving the game, which would in the future allow us to create the content needed for a fully fledged game, and not focus on actually creating that content for this thesis.
So when we were discussing which engine we were going to use, we ended up with Unreal Engine. The main reason for this is that in order to integrate Vulkan support with our game, we needed to have access to the source code, and Unreal Engine provides that. It was also an added bonus that Unreal Engine written in C++, which is the language that we are most familiar with. And thirdly, we also get access to Unreal Motion graphics, which we use for our UI development. The responsibilities were divided into the following. I would take care of most of the UI elements and the systems necessary to have them, so inventory items and the talent tree. Christian would focus on various background components, like statistics, spellcasting components, and the AI. And Pepe would focus on the Vulkan, all the Vulkan related work.
So when designing our game, we drew inspiration from a lot of similar games in the same genre. We chose to look at all these different games by their individual systems and decide what parts of those systems we liked and disliked, which we wanted in our game, and if we wanted to modify those to fit our game better. As a result of this, we ended up with a complex and diverse statistics system with over 100 different stats for the player, an inventory system which had an unlimited capacity, and the talent system which allowed the player to choose from all the talent trees without any class restrictions. combine all these systems together, formed a system with a huge amount of possibilities for the players to customize their own experience.
Alright, so now we'll have a live demo. We'll go through all the features that we implement. So this is the entry point for the game, in the main menu, where we can go through character selection, configuration, where we can set game settings and graphic settings. And then we have a credits page. So we'll go into character creation, and now we can see that we have a pre-existing character called Cardboard Bob. We can also create new characters, but for the purpose of this demonstration, we will be using a pre-existing one. Start. So here's the world we have loaded in with our character, and start moving. So the first thing that happens now, an enemy has spotted us, and it's going to try to kill us. So we need to defend ourselves. So in order to do that, we need to have access to some spells and abilities. So we have to open the talent tree. Here's the talent tree, which is automatically generated by the amount of different types of talent trees we have, and filled with the data reported from Google search. Currently, we only have the fire talents imported, but it would automatically import them depending on which type of talent tree they would belong to. So for now, let's grab the fireball talent and the flame strike. Now, if we open the skill window, they should be available for the player to drag to the action bar and utilize. Now, after using the ability, you can see that the mana has been spent, and fireball is quite an expensive mana to get. So in order to cast fireball more often, we need to have some sort of items that grant us mana regeneration. And currently, we have no items equipped. So this, we can also expand these statistics to show all the stats we have in the game. Some of them are offensive in nature, others defensive. We can select the multiple statistics as favorites so that they appear in the previous menu. So you can keep special stats that are important for your build. So for now, let's open the inventory system, which is designed in a way that complements our implementation for unlimited capacity, where all items are sorted into categories by their type. And the categories can be expanded and collapsed. If a category does not have any items in it, or all the children of the category are hidden, the category will disappear automatically, as it's not very relevant to display a category that has no information. Also drop items on the ground. But for now, let's use our filtering system, which is another implementation that helps us find items that we're looking for. So we can specify that we want to see all the items with given stat or type or rarity. So we're searching now for mana regeneration per second. And we can equip these items, and we can automatically see that the stats is updated in the favorite. Now that we have some mana regeneration, we can go back to gameplay and use our fireball more often. So now that we have a group of multiple enemies, where the fireball is not very good, as it only deals damage in a very small radius. Instead, we have the flame strike ability, which has a very large radius. And lastly, we want to show our development tool that we created early on in the development process, which would be used to, during runtime, create items and spawn AI. We can specify different variables for the items and either spawn them in the world or in the inventory of the player. We can also generate random items, actually for the demo, we wanted to show off something really cool. So firstly, we have to go in the inventory and affect a really powerful item. To find this item, we are searching by its name. The stack of power. It has a lot of good stats on it that modify the effect of the spell. So now we can spawn, let's say, 300 AI. And use flame break, which has now been scaled up because of the stats.
So I'll talk a little bit about this. I wanted to work in Vulcan because it's a new graphics API that is designed to take advantage of the modern hardware we have it today. The older graphics APIs are commonly used, don't support multi-threading, and there's been a lot of pipeline optimizations on the hardware side that we have. So Vulcan will allow, potentially allow for increased performance and lower overhead when it comes to rendering. It also has a built-in compute support with the ability to push out variables with the other pipeline, so you can perform a lot more simulations. Without having to go back to use it all the data. I'm integrating Vulcan in Unreal Engine so that we can use the features of Vulcan with the features of the engine, so we don't have to go into the gap, if that is possible for this project. When I had the updated version of Unreal Engine used, because there were some nice features added that would help the development of our game, and they updated the rendering interface to the FPV engine, which would enable some features that were missing from Vulcan that were almost essential for doing the dynamic destruction. But when I had implemented Vulcan in the new pipeline, there was a bug that caused it to not work anymore. So now I have to make a decision to decide to go with a separate demo of the dynamic destruction system with the intention of implementing it in the Unreal Engine on the problem. So I was just discovering different ways of doing dynamic destruction, and I found one that looks very interesting. And it's a lot better than the standard way, which is that you have the argument to divide the moments into broken pieces before the game is created, and then just replace the pieces of the pieces when it's destroyed. So, the Mobile Account to release it, it's capable of running actual real time destruction, is that it uses approximation. Of the model and simplifies the area you have to run calculations on. And it creates a volume around parts of the existing model into the representation of one of on the left. And then it works on that instead of the entire original mesh, which is very expensive computationally. And then the representation is quite discrete to subdivide when factors applied are affecting how the reflection should look. And you can see how it looks when you're in the model to do that with this. So this is something you can only do because of the flow field. I'll now do a small demo of the dynamic destruction system. The demo is very rough as it's implemented in a poorly built framework.
And you'll see some graphical glitches due to how I handle models in a very bad way. There's an issue with the draw. The draw sequence that causes some points to be drawn in the wrong order. You can see I use a simple cross pattern for the destruction, but that's easy to change. And you can see it breaks where I click. It's a bit inaccurate because I don't have any physics or anything implemented. That would be far too much to do after having implemented the Vulcan in the Unreal Engine. So,
as a condition for the project, with you we would face a huge workload working to implement the large game. We did scope down the project, but there were still parts of it that we hadn't really worked with before that still surprised us on the amount of work that had to be done on them. But we learned how to develop a game using a professional game engine, and thereby the ins and outs of using that game engine. You also learned programming concepts such as template programming and how to work with component-based systems. For further work on the project, integrating what Petter had done with Vulcan into the game would be one of the main steps, and adding multiplayer support for the game, which was scoped out due to time constraints, as well as the level generation. Did we reach our goals? I would say yes, and we all agree on this. We had scoped down the project to focus on the systems that would be needed to implement the game, and with the exception of the random level generation, we implemented what we had scoped the project to, and the implementations we think are fairly well done.
Started with the individual parts, so when I was doing the UI, I started with like the inventory, did that separately, and then I would have the talent tree, and then I would have the skill window, and the interaction between these windows would be implemented once the other one was finished. In that sense, it would just be the visual first, and then the functionality between them.
As for the background functionality, it was subdivided into different components where we could do this efficiently, and I think we split up the problems into smaller problems fairly well during our implementation, and we didn't really lose track of what needed to be worked on.
Spell balancing, that would be done sort of at a later stage when you have multiple or more spells available. We could do as you suggested previously, where we would have an AI start using the abilities and sort of figure out how optimal the abilities were compared to each other. As the complexity of this game can be very, very large, it would be harder to develop, as we would have talents that affect other spells and other talent trees, and certain stats being very good with these talents compared to others. Sort of like we have a frost spell which stuns an enemy 10% increased survivability as a result, because the enemy would be stunned and couldn't hit you back. So it would add additional defensive properties by having more of an offensive ability. Never get it right. During the design phase, we sort of sat down and started writing the design documents and just got carried away. So some aspects of that was shown in like the talent tree, where you have different talent trees that we wanted to have in the game but didn't have any data for at the moment. So we could have scaled it down. But with the general idea of the game, would be to have
large amounts of content so that you can customize between them to make your character really unique.
Last year this degree exists. We have a 6 year group coming through, but they're the last game programmers that we train here as game programmers. Tomorrow night we have a dinner, which the bachelor students hopefully have received invitations to. And some are any of you planning on going? Oh, good, because 1 year I had none of my students turn up. And I turned up and was kind of, oh. And you know, when they said, you know, when they called around the group, and then we designed and set up, and the program team set up, and the game program set up, and it's good. Thank you very much.